Today's lecture, Gendered Lives, second part of Gendered Lives, is about home life. So we're building on what we talked about last week, where we talked about working lives, and today I'm going to talk about home life domesticity, basically. Let's talk about gender relations, first of all. Gender relations are social and not biological. Gender is a historical construct which historians have used. They're not interested in biological differences between the genders, though there are at least some biological differences. They're interested in like sociological mechanisms, how the genders are treated, how the genders interact with each other because of their genders. In early America, you can sum up gender relations very, very neatly in one word, which is patriarchy. That is a dominant form of gender relations. Means, of course, that there is a father figure in a household. Doesn't necessarily have to be the father. Could be a brother, could be an uncle. But there will be a dominant male in a household. Husbands are often talked about, referred to as being masters. Masters of their households. Masters of their own little homes. You know, an Englishman's home is his castle, that sort of ideology. Women are not the equal of men, either socially or, most importantly, legally. Women have a peculiar status, they're called femme couverte, they're covered women. Femme couverte mean that women don't have a separate legal identity separate from their husband. When you're a young girl, you're a member of your father's household. Your father does any sort of business that you might need to transact. So you have a male guardian effect. In effect, if your father's dead, then that guardianship role will be taken by another male relative, an uncle, a brother, cousin, whatever. On marriage, you become part of your husband's estate, basically. And your husband can transact all legal affairs in your name. As a woman, as a married woman, you are unable to make a contract, for instance. You're unable to sue anyone in court. But equally, you can't be sued in court. So you could run up debts, for instance, but your husband would be liable for it. You don't have any separate legal identity, basically. You are a couple of which you are the inferior part, if you're a woman. The only time that when women get a femme sole status, a single woman status, is when they're widowed. That's when women do get the powers to be in business on their own. Most of women spend most of their time in the home. I talked very briefly last week about some women being outside of the home, getting jobs, perhaps covering for husbands who are away at war or something like that. Well, they are the exception. The vast majority of women's lives are domestic. And this leads to the development of an ideology of spheres. That the woman's sphere of influence is in the home, the man's sphere of influence is in the wider world, the political world, the world of work. Even though, however, he retains his role as master of the household, she's the one who actually runs it. And this fits in with contemporary notions of what a man should be and what a woman should be. A woman should be nurturing, caring, looking after children, doing domestic work. A man should be a leader. He shouldn't be doing chores. Women should be doing that sort of thing. But any sort of detailed look at the criminal records of the American colonies will show you that ideas of gender norms are really there as ideals, and there's a lot of people who never live up to those ideals, and there's a lot of gender deviancy, things such as homosexuality, which is heavily frowned on throughout the Americas, and you know, transvesticism. These things exist. People who are stepping outside of their gender roles, doing things that they shouldn't be doing, but they are definitely seen as deviants. And treated as such. So this is the ideal family, sort of sometimes called the stepping stone type of family, whereby you get an older couple and a number of children. It's possible these two are like the eldest daughter and her husband, and this is their child, or their two children. But, you know, a woman would have children at, say, 2-year intervals, 18-month intervals, something like that. And, you know, they'd be set in age, and she would continue to bear children until she reached menopause. So that's the ideal family. And here's another example of it, which is a rather odd painting, because all their heads are very slightly large and freaky, aren't they? It's called the Savage Family. This is a classic example of a portrait that's been painted and the heads are painted on afterwards. So it's like if you're an artist, you draw the portrait and then, you know, somebody's commissioned you and you say, okay, I want a portrait for my 11 members of my family. So the guy draws the portrait and then he comes and actually just paints the heads in at the last minute. But he's got his perspective slightly wrong because they all have freakishly large heads. Of course, it's possible the Savage Family did have freakishly large heads. But somehow I think not. But again, you see the steps there. So these ones in the middle look like they're kneeling down, don't they? So,
all slightly odd, aren't they?
Then here's an idea of deviancy. This is a portrait, supposedly, of Edward Hyde, Lord Cornbury, who is, in the early 18th century, governor of New York and New Jersey, dressed as a woman. Several contemporary sources talked about Hyde's transvesticism. Apparently he liked to dress as a woman in honour of his queen, Queen Anne. Queen Anne was actually his cousin. His aunt was queen consort to James II, and therefore it was Queen Anne's mother. There is some debate about whether this is an actual portrait of him, or it's a surprisingly elderly woman, but it lies in the New York Historical Society with that title. This is Edward Hyde. But he was eventually dismissed and lost his position, not mainly because of his transvesticism, but because he was just generally a bit bothered and corrupt. Gender relations aren't the same across the Americas. They are diverse, as one would think you will have learned by now, because we've talked about regional differences a lot. In the Chesapeake, you could say you've got opportunities as a woman which you lack elsewhere in the Americas, mainly out of the value which is attributed to a scarce commodity. There aren't that many women, therefore they are very highly valued. There are a number of demographic factors that conspire to raise the average age of marriage higher than normal, often in the late 20s. And it's partly because a very large proportion of the population of Virginia are indentured servants, and indentured servants aren't allowed to marry until they've reached the end of their indenture. Remember, it's 7 years the term of their indenture. So if they arrive and say they're in their early 20s, they're going to be in their late 20s before they're free and able to marry. And also the shortage of women means that about a quarter of men never marry. So most women, of course, do marry because there are so many men. But the demography of the Chesapeake, remember early death, remember all the way back to the last term, means that marriages last on average about 7 years. They only, on average, produce about 2 to 3 children. And sometimes historians talk about this as being a compressed life cycle, in that people marry late, they have only a small number of children, and they die young. And so they've compressed their entire life into perhaps 10 or 15 years. Sometimes that can take 30 or 40 years. And to replace the nuclear family, to replace the parents' children, pattern of family life, you get the extended family of stepfathers, brothers and sisters, half-sisters, half-brothers, and these sorts of replace the nuclear family. Generally, women didn't have a good life expectancy in the Chesapeake. And that's partly because of there's a lot of risk of infections, especially following childbirth. Malaria is something that weakens you. It's endemic in Tidewater, Virginia. So, it means it's not a good you know, there are pluses and minuses to being a woman in the Chesapeake, and this is one of the minuses, is that you're not likely to live very long. But in order to marry somebody who you know is fertile, people often wait until their bride is pregnant, so their future wife is pregnant, before they get married. It's known as bridal pregnancy, and it's very common in America. Three times as common as it is in England. It's not uncommon in England. It's not rare in England. We don't think of Victorian morality as being how morals were like before the 20th century, when everyone got free love and, you know, sex all the time. But actually, in the early modern period, bridal pregnancy is pretty common. A lot of people have sex before marriage. But in Virginia, they do it even more so. Or at least they had so much sex they were pregnant when they got married. New England, of course, is different. I think I've yet to reach a lecture where I say New England was exactly the same. It's much more like England, partly because the demography is a lot more English. You've got balances between the sexes. You've got nuclear families. You've got youthful marriage, late teens, early 20s. Most of you would be married now. Some of you would already have children. So you're all getting on a bit. You're all, you know, waiting, those biological clocks are ticking. But of course they would have more children as well. So they would, you know, marry young, be married for much longer, and have a lot more children. So instead of a compressed life cycle, you've got a much more elongated one. Of course, the Puritan family, the Puritan father, has this sort of patriarchal role, you know, ordained by God. He is the one who's meant to be in charge. Women are the inferior sex. Women, remember, who tempted Adam. It's Eve who tempted Adam. Women are responsible for the fall from grace. Only because of Eve was mankind thrown out of the Garden of Eden. It's a sin you all have to bear. And if you're a Puritan, every woman bears that sin. In the way that men don't. Society is generally more closed to women. There are few social opportunities for women. And you know, generally it's just a little bit more sort of stifling, I guess. But that doesn't mean that, you know, Puritans aren't having sex. The number of children they have suggests that they are having lots of sex. And some historians have talked about Puritans as being, you know, lusty Elizabethans, which is what they are, but they are lusty Elizabethans within marriage. But not everybody can keep to this sort of strict moral code. You get lots of prosecutions for adultery, bastardy, those sorts of things are pretty common. One thing that again distinguishes the Chesapeake and New England is that in the Chesapeake, remarriage is relatively common, especially if you're a woman. For men, less so, but in New England, the majority of people only marry once. So marriage tends to be much more of a longer term commitment, more of a life sentence. Let's look at it on, you know, cheery terms. Well, how do men and women get together? How do they find each other? They don't have matchups, they don't have speed dating. They have old-fashioned courtship. This is not Jane Austen. This is not, you know, Mr. Rochester has got a, you know, fortune of £5,000 a year. I think you should marry him, darling. It's not like that. There's a lot of free choice. A lot of people, you know, women do get to choose their husbands. Men get to choose their wives. Parents obviously have a role, but they have a role today. You know, your parents will not be shy usually about saying, "I don't think he's any good for you, darling." You know. That's especially common in New England, where parents are, you know, a bit more influential. That's partly because there are more parents, of course. But as I said, we should get away from imposing notions of Victorian morality on a previous century. In the 18th century, you remember, is the era of the libertine and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So morality is generally a bit more relaxed in Victorian times. Certainly premarital sex is very common. They even have a cute little word for it, bundling, where a couple would be betrothed, and in a way, betrothal is a bit like marriage. And so it's all right to have sex with somebody if you're betrothed to them. So that's like when you get engaged. So then it's okay. And you can, if you're a woman, with perfect propriety and dignity, say no to a man. You don't have to accept a marriage proposal. But it's generally seen as that you can't say no if you've actually had sex with somebody, because that's really not the done thing. Courtship is a lot more formal by the 18th century. It becomes a bit more stylized, a bit more chaperoned. Bundling is perhaps not quite so common. It's partly a class thing. Wealthy people are much more likely to have limitations on things like premarital sex than ordinary working class people aren't really that bothered about that sort of thing. But certainly you get a bit more formalising of courtship. And you get a book such as this, published in Philadelphia in 1746, Reflections on Courtship and Marriage. That of happy matches are often occasioned by mere mercenary views in one or both of the parties, or by the headstrong motives of ill-conducted passion, and that by a prudent and judicious proceeding in our addresses to a young lady of good natural temper, a probable foundation may be laid for making her an agreeable companion, a steady friend, and a good wife. So, these advice manuals begin to be printed in the 18th century. Often printed for men, you know, what you should look for in a wife, or a prospective wife. Marriage, well, in the 18th century, marriages have sort of stabilised, being early 20s for both sexes. Men are slightly older than women. I would say that's fairly similar to what they are today, though I think average age of marriage is a lot older today than that. But generally men are a year or two older than their wives, partly because men are supposedly mature. Some women, those with property, draw up premarital agreements, and this is in order to protect their assets, in terms of what happens to their land, their dowry perhaps. There are some suspicions that husbands will marry somebody in order to take their money and then or take their land and then sell it. And usually a dowry or a premarital agreement protects such land from sale. The husband is allowed to use the land, you know, earn the profits from it, but not usually allowed to sell it. And the land is bequeathed by the wife to children or whoever she wants to bequeath it to. There are regulations as well as to the minimum amount that a man has to leave his wife on death. Usually a third, that he can't disinherit his wife. He has to leave a third of his estate to his wife. Sometimes they get, you know, more. Depends how many children they have, often. Divorce is not unknown. It's not common, but not unknown. In some colonies, it's not allowed. Sometimes you can get something called separation from bed and board, where you get a legal recognition of a separation, where a husband does things like take out an advertisement in the newspaper saying, I'm not liable for my wife's debts, she has now left me, she is responsible for her own debts. You think it was a bit embarrassing to put that in the newspaper, but they do. So you get this sort of separation from bed and board, where you don't get a formal divorce. And often divorces and separations are caused by infidelity, sometimes by drunkenness, sometimes by violence, beatings of wives, etc. Remember, I think I told you this before, the rule of thumb, whereby a man is allowed to beat his wife so long as the stick is not thicker than his thumb. You know, those sorts of things can cause tensions in a marriage. You know, not many women think that's a good idea. So here's an example, slightly after our period, but painting illustrates it anyway, but it's sort of courtship, marriage ideal, sort of love, fidelity. I mean, here she is carrying apples, symbols of her fecundity. And here he is saying, look at my enormous telescope. And here is another piece of advice literature, a well-ordered family. A husband and wife should be patient one toward another.
If both are truly pious, yet neither of them is perfectly holy, in such cases a patient, forgiving, forbearing spirit is very needful. When, therefore, they quarrel or disagree, then they do the devil's work. He is pleased at it, glad of it, but such a contention provokes God, it dishonours him. It is a vile example before inferiors in the family. It tends to prevent family prayer. The husband's government ought to be gentle and easy, and the wife's obedience ready and cheerful. The husband is called the head of the woman. It belongs to the head to rule and govern. The wives are part of the house and family and ought to be under the husband's government, yet his government should not be with rigour, haughtiness, harshness, severity, but with the greatest love, gentleness, kindness, tenderness that may be. Though he governs her, he must not treat her as a servant, but as his own flesh. He must love her as himself. So, these are very widely, you know, read, a piece of advice literature, widely circulated, and conforms with the sort of gender relation patterns that we come to expect. But not everybody agrees with that. This is a different take on it. It's called Look A Leap, or A History of Lewd Women, first published in England in the earlier 18th century, but there is a Boston edition in 1762. It talks about women. For no sooner can they lisp, but they can lie, and are taught by their mothers to disguise the truth. They are not what they appear to be. For if a man aims at riches, she shall pretend to a great fortune, though she is worse than nothing, and run in debt to make a good appearance. And if she can persuade the deluded lover to make her his wife, he shall be arrested for all these things before he has been married a week. And if a man be taken by beauty, she will both wash and paint, and patch and dress and do everything that make her appear fair. If he chance to marry her, he'll find, when the morning light comes to discover her, he has got a very devil in his arms.
So this is basically a book warning men about the wiles of women. So not everything about advice literature is saying, you know, love's, you know, brilliant and we should all be in love with people and, you know, be very happy together. And, some of them are saying, actually, you shouldn't get married, it's terrible, and, you know, this is clearly written by somebody who's been shafted by a woman, I think, you know, who has come and taken all his money, or he married her and then really regretted it. What do women do? What is the domestic role? Well, they look after their husbands. That's priority number one, numero uno, is care for their husbands. That means they look after his physical needs, his mental needs, make sure all the cares of the world are eased from his shoulders, make sure his dinner is on the table, rub his feet when he comes in, give him the nice seat in front of the fire, don't pester him with annoying questions. That's the woman's role. Obviously she should look after the children. Part of that role is also undertaking the education of children. She should manage household affairs. She should look after all the food, provide the food, cook it, do all the cleaning and washing in the house. Unless, of course, she's got servants, in which case she should manage them doing it. She should help around the farm, milk the cows, perhaps come and help at harvest time. Women also talk to one another a lot. One historian has talked about so-called homosocial networks, and by which she means women going and visiting each other, which they do a lot. Instead of talking to each other on the phone, they go and visit each other, visit neighbours, have coffee, share childcare, help out when your neighbour's having another child, perhaps in labour, perhaps you've got midwife skills. And this is a classic example here. Elizabeth and Mary Freke painted mother and child, picture of domestic bliss. Mr. Freke paints, has a completely separate portrait. It's never that, you know, never obviously occurs to him that he should be in the portrait with his wife and child. Instead, he has his own separate portrait. Again, a grandmother and a child. You get a lot of these examples of women and their children in the portraiture.
Not many people, unless it's a big family portrait, have the man and a child. And this is an odd picture. Painted by Charles Wilson Beale. And it's of a picture of his own wife grieving at the death of their own daughter. But he didn't put himself in the picture. He's not the one sobbing. He just painted his wife crying. And it's quite a sad picture. But quite why he chose to omit himself from it is, I think, revealing of men's attitudes towards family life. These are the sorts of domestic environments they might live in. One room, maybe two room buildings. For the majority of people, obviously some people have big mansions, but most people will be living in little simple one room, two room houses. Doing things like milking the cows. Or spinning, of course, domestic work, making clothes. That's a very important part of a woman's job. Of course, not everybody's doing all that work. If you're an elite woman, you have slaves to do the work for you. But you do have to manage those people. Sometimes, if you've got a big household, you've got 50 slaves, 10 of whom are in the house doing domestic work, then you've got to manage all those people, make sure they're all doing the right things at the same time, and coordinate them all. And that's a bit like running a business. So, childbirth. Obviously an important part of women's lives. Early American women have lots of children, partly why the population grows so quickly. A woman over, say, a 25-year period of her fertile life might have between 10 to 15 children. And this many children is partly because there aren't any resource restraints on population growth. Usually in England, the amount of land you've got, or diets, or all those sorts of things restrict population growth. Whereas in America, there's plenty of resources, plenty of land, so there's not the same restrictions. And of course, contraception is not widely practiced. Women generally do know about the natural cycles, and they know when they are most likely to conceive and when not. And some women pay more attention to that than others. But in America, again, there's no real need to do it unless you just simply don't want to have any more children. The most important person in a childbirth is the midwife. She's the one who actually knows what she's doing. You generally don't want a doctor. And in the course of the colonial period, childbirth moves from being a very single-sex environment where all men are excluded to being one where some elite people are including male doctors, but they aren't that much use, I don't think. Even now, if the time comes when you're having children, you'll find most of the time that a male doctor isn't as much use as a skilled midwife. Not unless you need surgery. And of course, with these 10 to 15 children, not all of them will survive to adulthood. Around a quarter, but perhaps 2 to 3, 4 wouldn't live to be 21. So infant mortality is very high. It's much, much higher than it is now. A birthing stool is a very common childbirth piece of equipment. It's a stool which is cut out in the middle. And it helps, it uses gravity to help deliver the child. So the midwife here can sort of catch it as it pops out. This is with a male midwife, but of course for decency's sake he's not looking, and he's got the gown taped around his neck, which does make you wonder how effective he's going to be when he's just sort of groping around thinking what does this bit do? Which is why I say that I think a female midwife is generally a lot more use. Especially in the early modern period, because at least she does know what she's doing. But if there's no skilled midwife in the neighbourhood, just another female who has perhaps got her own children, who's been through childbirth before, for instance, would be useful. More so than a man, who generally don't know what they're doing, or really want to know anything about what they might want to be doing.
Of course, the end product of childbirth is children. I talked before about the different life expectancies and life experiences of children in the Chesapeake and New England. New England, you grew up in a nuclear family, you've got a strict hierarchy of discipline, patriarchy. In the Chesapeake, you've got no nuclear family, most likely no parents, far fewer restraints on your behaviour. These extremes are moderated in the 18th century, and family life becomes a little bit more similar for children. But children are under the control of their father or the male role model in the household. They are regularly disciplined. A child needs boundaries, needs discipline in order to learn. And that might require physical chastisement. Certainly that's not ruled out in most early modern societies. Beating of children is very common. Teach children their place, which is the sort of seen and not heard variety. As children grow up, they do also get treated differently. Boys are seen as people who need, you know, extra training, education. They need to be taught how to be a farmer or a carpenter or a blacksmith or whatever job they're going to be. Girls get far less of that sort of education and training. Their role in the future is to be mothers, and so they might learn domestic work from their mother. They might learn a smattering of education, but not as directed as it is of boys. The reason why it's important for women to have at least a smattering or a modicum of education is because they are often the roots, the starting point of education for children. Children learn at home, they learn at their mother's knee. If she can, like, at least spell or count, then you've started off the children in the right way. Of course, if she can do more than that, then that's beneficial to the children as well. Children only attend school seasonally. They don't tend to attend most often in the winter months, when there's no agricultural work to be done. But when there's crops to be sown, hoed, harvested, and those are all things which demand a child's time far more than schooling. And you would only really attend school for a few years. So a few months over a few years. Probably from being 7 or 8 to being about 12, 13, 14. And boys got more schooling than girls. Girls would perhaps only be sent for 3 or 4 years, boys might be sent for 5 or 6. Not because boys are stupid, which is a rationale for it, but more because they need more education, they're going to learn more. Schooling is problematic. Lots of places don't have schools. Schooling costs money, unless there are charity schools or parish schools nearby. In lots of places there aren't charity schools, but there are some, there are a few. But elsewhere you have to try and club together, raise money to try and pay for a teacher to come for a few months a year. And the problem is, you don't know really what you're getting with this teacher. You might have the money to pay a teacher, you know, a number of local families join together and pay for a teacher. He might be an alcoholic, might be literate, you know, there's lots of things where you think you're getting something and you actually don't get something. So, nowhere has a comprehensive system of education, of schooling their children. Those are all 19th century developments. Most people say what you really need is basic literacy, basic numeracy, which is what a lot of people have. In New England, especially, you know, the numeracy and literacy are relatively widespread, probably far more widespread than they are in England. Not so much in Virginia. But they're getting that basic literacy often from the home and not from schooling. And there's only the elite, I think, have the money to pay for proper education, what you might call call a decent education. And these people often then send their grown-up children, their 18, 20-year-olds, to England for university or college education. Though there are increasing numbers of American colleges, higher education is generally English until about 1800. After 1800, there are increasingly significant numbers of American universities and American colleges. So there is a gradual shift there. And you can see the earliest university is Harvard, founded within 6 years of the founding of the colony in Massachusetts Bay. But then it's another 60-odd years before the second college is founded, which is the College of William & Mary in Virginia. And then in the 18th century, there's Yale in Connecticut. Princeton, we talked about Princeton, I think, a couple of weeks ago with the Great Awakening, has a religious foundation. College of Philadelphia, which is now the University of Pennsylvania. Columbia in New York, 1754. Brown University in Rhode Island, 1764. And then the College of Charleston in the Deep South in South Carolina in 1770. There are a number of others that are founded in the States, or that are already, you know, there's like others in Connecticut or others in Rhode Island, but I didn't put them in. I just wanted to put in like the first in each state. So, but still, there's no more than about a dozen at the time of the Revolution. So, there's not a huge mass of colleges. But when they build them pretty impressively. Big, imposing buildings, built on the sort of Oxbridge style. Lots of 18th century classicism here. William and Mary, even more so. So, the domestic sphere is a woman's sphere. It's somewhere where women have control, even though men are the people who are supposedly in charge. I mean, you might say men have nominal control, but women have practical control. A woman's life is constrained by how society views her. And views her abilities to adapt in that society. And families, and especially their children, are a way for women to have a fulfilling life because they don't have the opportunities outside the family life. And so women channel their energies into their children and raising their children and being, you know, a good wife. And that is fulfilling both a domestic ideal and a very practical ideal. For early American society.